From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's not easy to keep your head in the court of King Henry VIII. Thomas More, the man for all seasons, lost his over power and the church, beheaded. We know what happens to Anne Boleyn, no male heir, off with her head. Thomas Cromwell, the king's right-hand man, has his head for now, but it takes vast cunning. He's read Machiavelli's The Prince in Hilary Mantel's latest historical fiction and finds it trite. This hour, On Point, the age of Henry VIII, Hilary Mantel and her latest Bring Up the Bodies. You can join the conversation. Did you read Hilary Mantel's best-selling, award-winning Wolf Hall? Did she take you back to that world in a new way? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Exeter, England, is Hilary Mantel, author now of 10 novels and a memoir. Her big bestseller, Wolf Hall, won both the Man Booker Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award. Her sequel, Bring Up the Bodies, is just out and getting great reviews. Hilary Mantel, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You must have been talking to a lot of people. It's great to have you. Your first Wolf Hall on this point in history was such an enormous success. Would you be kind and generous enough to set the stage for us as Bring Up the Bodies begins? What's going on for people who don't know your great retelling?
In 1535, end of the summer, Thomas More died in July. The very day of his execution, the king goes on holiday. He goes off with the court on a progress through the West Country. They visit Wolf Hall, home of the Seymour family, where Henry's eye falls on the demure, self-effacing daughter of the family, plain Jane Seymour, who nobody's ever wanted before. And Thomas Cromwell knows that something's going on. This is the point where Bring Up the Bodies begins. Cromwell is close to Henry. He's quick on the uptake. He knows Jane. And he thinks, are we possibly looking at wife number three?
And of course, you're right. And the king, not getting his male issue from Anne Boleyn, Anne of a Thousand Days, as many know her. Her head not exactly secure on her shoulders.
No, at this point, it really looks, because Anne and the king are quarrelling, by late summer it looks as if she may be on her way out. And then off to London they go. The autumn term gets underway in the law courts, everyone's busy, the king's council gathers, and suddenly Anne's pregnant. So, fortunes turn, maybe put the Seymours on hold, let's see what Anne can produce. And then, the turn of the year, Henry's first wife, who's still alive in exile in the country, dies. And on the day of her funeral, Anne Boleyn miscarries for the second time. And Henry comes to the conclusion that this marriage is not the one that will give him his longed-for son.
Hilary Mantel, remind us, if you would. I mean, there is high drama all over these stories, and you tell them so well, but remind us why this point in history is such an important juncture in English history. I mean, Thomas More in Wolf Hall, the head is lost there. The church and the Pope at loggerheads with Henry VIII, and, you know, these vast movements in English history around his love life. Remind us why it's so key.
Why Henry's love life is so crucial. He's only the second Tudor king, and the Tudor dynasty is young, it's insecure. Their claim to the throne isn't really that strong. They've got the throne because they won the battle. Having got it, they have to hold it. Now, Henry's got a daughter. But in those days, of course, a daughter's no good. A king has to be a war leader. He has to be able to take his nation into battle. So Henry's looking for sons to secure his line. His first wife, Catherine of Aragon, had numerous pregnancies, but the child would die just before birth or just after birth, it was a series of tragedies. Mm. He's got one daughter, Princess Mary, now in her teens. He gets locked into a struggle to have his marriage annulled. The Pope won't cooperate. Europe is against him. Catherine's nephew is the powerful Emperor Charles V. The whole divorce process gets knotted up. It's been dragging along for years. Thomas Cromwell comes along.
Mm-hmm.
New idea. Your Majesty, why not set up your own church and grant your own divorce? Of course, I'm hugely oversimplifying here, but in a nutshell, this is what occurs. Henry separates from Rome, breaks off his relations with the Pope, declares himself head of the church in England, grants his own divorce. Anne Boleyn is now queen. Expectations are high. She's pregnant. Henry is so sure of the outcome that when she goes into labour, he has a proclamation put out declaring the birth of a prince.
Mm.
And then it's a go. It's only a go. And there are the proclamations. And he has to have some extra letters squashed in to say princess.
Mm.
Now, this girl is Elizabeth. She's going to be one of the greatest rulers England ever has. But
yes.
Henry doesn't know that. He doesn't have foresight. As far as he's concerned, Anne's failed. She has another child. It dies before birth. So we come to this point in 1535. Henry's saying to himself, I did all this for her. And how she paid me back. She's broken her promises. And, you know, they've been waiting for such a long time to get into bed together. Maybe when they did, it was some kind of anticlimax. Mm. Because their relationship is, it's passionate, it's fiery. They wear their quarrels like ornaments. But Anne is arrogant. She's disliked by the people around her. Not an easy person to work with.
Mm.
Thomas Cromwell has supported her. He's helped her to power as she has helped him to power. And then you come to this point where Bring Up the Bodies begins, and Anne and Cromwell are looking at each other and they are saying, you are in my way.
Mm.
Cromwell was supposed to be the servant, but at this point he's on his way to becoming Anne's master, the person who is closest to the king.
Mm.
He and Anne quarrel. She threatens him, and the writing's on the wall.
In so much popular history, it's Thomas More, the man for all seasons, who is the great one. And even at his time, he was so admired. The Reformation martyr Erasmus called him, described him as one whose soul is more pure than any snow, whose genius was such that England never had and never again will have its like. And it's your Thomas Cromwell who's the bad guy, the consigliere, but the made to look like a murderer in this Holbein portrait. You know, it's the Frick now. He looks like made him look like Tony Soprano, our sort of mob guy here. But he's your hero in a way. What took you to Thomas Cromwell? Why him?
Well, just to go back to Thomas More for a moment, mm-hmm. He's a great intellectual, but he's also a politician, and he plays the game and he has to take the consequences. As Thomas Cromwell says in Wolf Hall, he didn't get to be Lord Chancellor by accident.
Mm.
So he's put himself out there. He's pitched himself into the political arena. He falls foul of Henry and he takes the consequences. Now, Thomas Cromwell was a very unusual man, because he came from a very humble background.
Mm-hmm.
His father was a blacksmith. He didn't have any education that we know of. His father was a very rough sort of man. He was a drinker, fighter. Thomas Cromwell ran away round about the age of 15. Then he's out of the kingdom for quite a few years.
Warring.
He he joins the French army as a mercenary. The French are fighting in Italy. He's present at one great battle there, a huge French defeat, an absolute disaster. Then somehow he pops up in Florence working for one of the banking houses. At first it seems he's just a servant, and then he works his way up to the counting house. And there's a germ of financial genius here, and the Italians are quick to see it. And then he pops up in different places in Europe.
Help now, help thy king, now, thy king, and take his power, and take his part, and take his part.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the world of Henry VIII, Thomas Cromwell, Thomas More, Anne Boleyn, and the new sequel to Hilary Mantel's celebrated historical fiction, Wolf Hall. It is Bring Up the Bodies. Hilary Mantel joins us today from Exeter, England. Wolf Hall, praise all over the place, huge sales, but also top prizes, Man Booker, National Book Critics Circle Award, and now the sequel, second of three, we're told, with the story, galloping toward more heads to be lost. A new perspective in this film from what many may be familiar with. Here's just a little bit from the 1996 movie A Man for All Seasons. Tells the story of the trial and beheading of Sir Thomas More, a good man felled by the intrigues of Henry VIII and his courtiers. In this, as in most tellings, King Henry's chief minister, Thomas Cromwell, is unscrupulous and devious and weaves a web of deceit around More. In this scene, Thomas Cromwell, played by Leo McKern, tightens the noose around Thomas More, played by Paul Scofield.
Sir Thomas More, have you anything to say to me regarding the king's marriage with Queen Anne?
I understood I was not to be asked that again.
Then evidently you understood wrongly. These charges
are terrors for children, Master Secretary. Not for me.
Then know that the king commands me to charge you in his name with great ingratitude.
So, I am brought here at last.
Brought? You brought yourself to where you stand now. You may go.
Yes, and the head will go too. Hilary Mantel joins us from Exeter, England. Hilary, I wish you'd read us a little bit, a description of your Thomas Cromwell. Quite a different picture, as we come to know in the course of these now two books. You start off just with kind of physical description and then something about where he's from, to the extent people know. Would you read for us? Would you be so kind from Bring Up the Bodies?
Sure. Thomas Cromwell's now about 50 years old. He has a labourer's body, stocky, youthful, running to fat. He has black hair, greying now, and because of his pale, impermeable skin, which seems designed to resist rain as well as sun, people sneer that his father was an Irishman. Though really, he was a brewer and a blacksmith at Putney, a man with a finger in every pie, a scrapper and a brawler, a drunk and a bully, a man often hauled before the justices for punching someone, for cheating someone. How the son of such a man has achieved his present eminence is a question all Europe asks. Some say Cromwell came up with the Boleyns, the Queen's family, and some say it was wholly through the late Cardinal Wolsey, his patron. Cromwell was in his confidence and made money for him and knew his secrets. Others say he haunts the company of sorcerers. He was out of the realm from boyhood, a hired soldier, a wool trader, a banker. No one knows where he's been and who he's met, and he's in no hurry to tell them.
Hilary Mantel reading from her new Bring Up the Bodies, just out sequel to Wolf Hall. Here you are with this more sympathetic look at Thomas Cromwell. Where did you get the chutzpah, the inclination, Hilary Mantel, to look more sympathetically at this man?
Well, you know, we've been under the sway of A Man for All Seasons for two generations. Excellent play, excellent film, but it was of its time. Robert Bolt portrayed Thomas More as a 1960s liberal, which is something that would have horrified Thomas More. He'd be turning in his grave. Time for a fresh look. Now, academic historians have known for a long time the central importance of Thomas Cromwell's work. They've known he was vital to this decade of tumultuous politics. But of course, academic historians aren't too interested in what a person is like. So Thomas Cromwell has been left to the popular historians, to the novelists. They've given him a bad press. Why? Because they've just inherited a bundle of prejudice handed down from previous generations. I thought, this man is at least interesting. So let's wipe the slate blank. Let's start again. Let's go back to the sources. And I found something that really astonished me. I was expecting to find a villain, but an interesting villain. Mm-hmm. What I found was a very clever, fascinating man with a sardonic sense of humour and a great broad humanity, which I have to say very often absent in the case of St. Thomas More. A man who was locked in a struggle for survival. No natural constituency, no powerful family to back him. Mm-hmm. Getting on just by his own brains, his own wits, his own personality. He had considerable charisma and charm, none of which you'd know from Leo McKern's impersonation.
Of course, this is... many will be more familiar with Oliver Cromwell, who was the great-great-grandson of Thomas Cromwell's sister, Catherine Cromwell.
That's right.
But then here's this man. Is it a? Can you really know that it's the way you present it, or is it inevitably in the end? You say it's just a result of you know people's imaginations. But is this just you bringing your prejudices to the source material, or is the source material really rich enough to factually justify it? Does it matter?
Yeah, I hate to cast aspersions on my fellow novelists, but they're often quite a lazy lot, and they do take their cue from what's been written before instead of going back to the sources. Now, Thomas Cromwell's hard to uncover because his political work is very well documented, but his private life is very well hidden. Nevertheless, I believe there's enough in it if you go back to the sources to build a picture of him as a man. You just see what his household was like, and you see what other people said about him, and you consider his work as a legislator, as a politician. He was an enormously forward-looking man. His great cause, of course, was the English Bible. And it was he who pushed and pushed until Henry agreed to allow the Bible to be translated into English and placed in the parish churches, at which point Cromwell didn't hang about. He paid the printer himself.
Wow.
And it's a landmark moment in... for all English-speaking people, when the Bible for the first time comes into the hands of the ordinary men and women, it's taken away from the elite and it's there for everyone to read.
Do you see him as a kind of class warrior in that way?
Not in any modern sense, because I think the concept of class was different in those days. Mm-hmm. We've got used to the idea that mobility between classes is highly possible and is a very good thing. But the 16th century didn't think that way. They thought what your father was what you should be, and that God had put us in our places and meant us to stick there. So when Cromwell came up from his background, he was resented by the nobility, who thought it was their place to advise the king. But he was also resented by the common people because they didn't see how he'd done it. And they thought he must be a sorcerer. There must be some kind of black magic going on here. So As I say, he had no natural constituency. He had his own wits to live on. But what he had was a very advanced reformist agenda, which he didn't live long enough to implement. But had he been able to put his ideas into practice, England would have been a very different country, and we would be feeling the consequences to the present day.
Put Cromwell, if you would, Hilary Mantel, in the frame next to the king he served, Henry VIII. I mean, again, in the sort of popular understanding of Henry VIII, here's this lustful, egotistical, harsh, insecure king. But these two men, side by side, their relationship, how each saw and came to see the other.
Yes, it's an interesting one. Henry, at this stage, he's 45 years old. You mustn't think of him as the obese monster he later became, or as the cruel and irrational man he later became. But 1536, this is a crucial year. Henry's on the turn, so to speak. He's always prided himself on his sporting prowess, his brilliant good health, his athleticism, and he's beginning to lose that. He has a serious accident that year, prevents him jousting anymore. This is his favourite sport, and he was a champion. It's a great blow to his masculine pride. Mm. Then again, the failure to conceive a son is another blow to his pride. Henry is a prize neurotic. He looks like a big, strong, self-sufficient man. He's a seething mass of insecurities. And dealing with him day by day, you have to have a personality like Cromwell's. Steadiness of nerve, great resilience. Whatever Henry does to you, you have to be ready to bounce back. You have to be quick and you have to be prepared for anything.
Take us through once more how he comes from the blacksmith's boy to the man who's capable of playing this very high-level game with the king. I mean, your original, Wolf Hall, opens with him being beaten by his father. He's abused. But here he is, this political genius, wide learning, all the languages, student of human nature. He's always one step ahead of the schemers around the king. Is his tour through Europe that somehow brought him all that? Is it tutelage elsewhere?
Well, I think what had happened by the time Cromwell came back to England in his early 20s, in his late 20s, and set himself up as a lawyer, he'd got international experience. He could speak several languages. His outlook was cosmopolitan. It was very different from that of the average lawyer or man of business. Now, he was talent spotted immediately by Cardinal Wolsey. Wolsey, at that time, was Henry's right-hand man. Hmm. Some said he was the other king. When Henry was a young man and wanted to enjoy himself, Wolsey said, "You go out and do as you like, Majesty, just leave it to me." Mm-hmm. And Wolsey held the reins of power. Cromwell was Wolsey's man. Wolsey trained him. When Wolsey fell over the divorce question, he couldn't get Henry his divorce, so his years of faithful service counted for nothing. Henry cut him down. Cromwell survived him. He was loyal to the cardinal. He protected him as best he could. But then he stepped into his shoes, and he became minister of everything. He was omnicompetent, and if he wasn't, he certainly learned quickly. And most of the business of government by this stage, 1536, passes through his hands. And yet he's still plain Master Cromwell. Mm. He's not Lord Cromwell, not at this stage.
But a man of parts, like we really, I would say, don't even see anymore. And then there's Anne Boleyn, who's on her way to trouble here. But you've got a wonderful passage that conveys something about her. Tremendous magnetism, sexual magnetism. I wonder if you might read a little bit for us about the Queen.
Yes, at this point, Anne and Cromwell are beginning to quarrel. His relations with the Queen, as summer draws to its official end, are cherry, uncertain, fraught with distrust. Anne Boleyn is now 34 years old, an elegant woman, with a refinement that makes mere prettiness seem redundant. Once sinuous, she's become angular. She retains her dark glitter, now rubbed a little, flaking in places. Her prominent dark eyes she uses to good effect. She glances at a man's face, and then her regard flits away, as if unconcerned, indifferent. There's a pause, and then slowly, as if compelled, she turns her gaze back to him. Her eyes rest on his face. She examines this man. She examines him as if he is the only man in the world. She looks as if she's seeing him for the first time and considering all sorts of uses for him, all sorts of possibilities which he hasn't even thought of himself. To her victim, the moment seems to last an age, during which shivers run up his spine. Though in fact the trick is quick, cheap, effective and repeatable, it seems to the poor fellow that he's now distinguished amongst all men. He smirks, he preens himself, he grows a little taller, he grows a little more foolish.
Hilary Mantel with Anne Boleyn there in her new Bring Up the Bodies. You call the man her victim, but of course she's the one. 1536, investigated for high treason, adultery, incest, and off comes her head. The evidence, everybody seems to think, quite unconvincing. Is that Thomas Cromwell? Was that pure injustice, Thomas Cromwell's villainy?
He was the king's servant. He wouldn't have acted against Anne unless the king had given him the order. And it would have had to have been a clear order too, because he couldn't risk mistaking the king's intention. There came the moment when Henry had decided Anne must go. He wanted a fresh chance with a new girl. How are they going to get rid of her? Well, maybe they could have the marriage annulled. The possibilities explored. But this is Anne. She's already told Thomas Cromwell, if he ever tried to get rid of me like he got rid of Catherine, it would be war. There's no way this woman is going to go quietly. And then disquieting rumours start to seep throughout the court. Anne is at the centre of a company of young men and women. The atmosphere sexually charged. We're poised on the brink of disaster.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the world of Henry VIII, Thomas Cromwell, Thomas More, Anne Boleyn, and the new sequel to Hilary Mantel's celebrated historical fiction, Wolf Hall. It is Bring Up the Bodies. She has taken her art right to the top of the charts, best-selling and the top awards for Wolf Hall, and now out with Bring Up the Bodies. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And she joins us today from Exeter in England. Talk about how the royal role may change. Here's Britain's Prince Charles, no doubt likely king one day, doing the weather report for the BBC out of their Glasgow studio last week. His forecast here paying a little extra attention to the royal real estate in Scotland. And the video's gone viral around the world.
Well, it's an unsettled picture as we head towards the end of the week. This afternoon it'll be cold, wet and windy across most of Scotland. We're under the influence of Low pressure.
Hilary Mantel joins us from Exeter, England. What did you make of that? What would Henry VIII have made of that little performance, madam?
I think it's a lot easier to be a royal nowadays.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, you might have walked away with a dagger in the back. We've got callers for you, and I want to get to them. Renee is calling from Reading, Connecticut. Renee, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Hilary Mantel.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to call and tell Ms. Mantel, I read Roald Dahl, and I thought the writing was so present, so gripping. And I'm a historian. I love history. But some of those books are incredibly dry, and this just felt so current that I couldn't put it down, and I'm on pins and needles. I cannot wait to get the next book.
What was it about the way she tells the history, Renee, that got it under your skin?
Well, it was just, it almost felt like you were there, and you were like a fly on the wall, and, you know, I don't know that much about Thomas Cromwell, so to learn about some of the backdoor stuff that was going on, and the whole book is from his point of view,
mm-hmm.
and I just thought it was just so intriguing the way the book was written. I mean, it was really fascinating. So I'm absolutely a huge fan.
And what about your sympathies as a woman reading of this king and his top advisor, you know, this king who goes through six wives?
Well, I mean, you know, that was the day and the age, and that was royal power, and that, you know, as a woman, you can't think about those things. I mean, it's a real drama and an intrigue, and I mean, many, many books have been written about all of these women, but this is just really a fresh take, and I just really love it. It's kudos. And I think she won the Man Booker Prize, am I not? Is that not correct?
Yes, she did, tip-top, and I appreciate your call, Renee. Lots of others along those lines. Samantha saying, why is she not the most famous writer on earth? Well, she's getting up there, Samantha, and right on. Hilary Mantel, what about you as a woman? I mean, Renee says, you know, as a woman, you can't think about those things. On the other hand, when you dig in as deeply as you have here, you have to. What about your gender sympathies as you write through this amazing history?
It's a very good question, but I made the decision that I'm going to put the camera on Thomas Cromwell's shoulder. So it's not really a question of what sympathies I, Hilary, may have. It's a question of how does Thomas Cromwell view this? Now, the women he's dealing with are not victims. Catherine of Aragon, highly intelligent, regal, brilliantly educated woman. And Anne Boleyn, feisty, determined, the author of her own destiny.
Very high-born family, powerful in its own right.
She's related to the Howard family. That's Thomas Howard, Duke of Norfolk, England's premier nobleman, is her uncle.
Mm-hmm.
These women are, as Cromwell takes them to be, worthy opponents. And he paid tribute to the bravery and the cleverness of both women. But in the end, I'm asking my reader to stand in his shoes and say, what would you do? And I think it's a shame to let modern gender politics get in the way or assume that Anne Boleyn is some kind of proto-feminist or that she's like a modern woman. I'm always trying to locate you in the age that these people are living in and show you their struggle. They don't know the end of their story. Henry, he doesn't know he's going to have six wives.
Mm-hmm.
Every wife, he's hopeful. She's the one.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we must beware of reading them backwards and judging them too harshly.
But it's hard not to bring our contemporary perspective. I mean, we've got women fuming out there. Mary writes to us online for you, Hilary. Fuming out there about the men's attitude where they're saying, let's see what Anne can produce in terms of a male heir. Mary writes to us, blithely ignoring the fact that it's the male sperm which is responsible for the sex of the child.
They didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. They didn't indeed. George in Lexington, Kentucky is calling. George, you're on the air with Hilary Mantel.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a more practical question. I don't have so much point, but my interest is really piqued on this Bring Up the Bodies. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask Hilary if I read that book out of sequence without reading Wolf Hall first, well, I'll be totally confused. Or
may I interject that you'll miss an opportunity because Wolf Hall is really fantastic as well. But what about it, Hillary?
It will bring up the bodies will make sense in its own terms, and it will lead you gently into who's who. The only thing is, if you do read Wolf Hall, you'll see how the characters got to 1536. You'll see them evolve, and maybe you could argue that's a more satisfying process. But this book's very different from Wolf Hall because it takes place over a period of only 9 months, and the action's very condensed. It's very dramatic. So it will lead you through the story to the climax, and the drama will spin away, and hopefully you'll get so involved in it that you won't stop to think, now, the Duke of Suffolk, who's
he? Right, but George and Lexington...
I hope I've done the job for you, so you'll know.
But take my advice, George, and don't skip the first course if you have the choice. Let's get another George. We've got kingly names running here. This is, and no less in South Kingstown, Rhode Island. History speaks to us here. George in Rhode Island, you're on the air in Kingstown. You're on the air with Hillary Mantel.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I was wondering what your guest thought of Shakespeare's take on King Richard III. Shakespeare had him an arch villain. People have written novels about him saying he was, you know, wrongly perceived. I think Shakespeare got his take on King Richard III from Holinshed's Chronicles, which were wrong.
That's a terrific question. Here's a talk about kings where our understanding is redrawn, or historical characters. Richard III, there's another. What about that transformation, Hillary?
Yes, he's been thoroughly rehabilitated, hasn't he? Mm. I'm not even sure he deserves it. But if I say that, I'll have millions of Richard's fans waiting for me outside the studio with the sword.
Yeah, right.
So I better back off that one.
Yeah, well, you don't think he deserves it, and yet it happens. You don't really redefine...
What I'm saying is, I'm not quite sure he deserves to become the saintly figure he's now become. I wonder if things have gone a little too far the other way. But look, all these men, Richard III, Henry VIII, Cromwell, they're hard men in a hard time. This is power politics. Nowadays, you make a mistake in politics, you get to resign. Or as the British always say, spend more time with your family. If you made a mistake in Henry's reign, you went off to the Tower of London and you very likely lost your head. The stakes were high. Every day was a crisis.
You've got some just plain, not plain really, but language in this book that takes us to another time. You've got an interesting combination in the speech you put in your characters, these historical characters' mouths. You don't try to make it exactly the speech of the time, and yet here pop up these words, gurning, G-U-R-N-I-N-G, a word I had never read. What is it?
Can you tell me that one again?
Gurning, G-U-R-N-I-N-G. Something about muscle tension.
Okay. This is a very British word. It means kind of pulling horrible faces. It's a word you'll still hear.
All right.
So that's down to Britishness, not to antiquity.
Agents of malefice.
Malefice. Well, yes. We were the opposite of benevolence, if you like. Agents of evil.
It comes across pretty well. Waffeting, I did not know.
What was that one again?
Well, it's my American pronunciation, I guess, but waffeting.
Oh, waffeting.
Yes, yes.
Well, you know, this is taken right from George Cavendish's Life of Cardinal Wolsey. He was a contemporary, and he writes about the day Cardinal Wolsey was arrested and taken away by river. And he says, there are all these little boats waffeting up and down, and you can see them with their little sails blowing on the wind, dancing across the sparkling Thames. I'm not sure it's even a real word or that it crops up anywhere else, but it seems so descriptive. And if I can, I like to use people's real words, scraps of reported conversation. And then what I have to do is smooth them into my own modern English so that the join doesn't show.
There's a modern sensibility in these books, but it runs up against realities of history that are so different, world apart from our own. I mean, you've got in the king's, somewhere there in the palace, you've got the groom of the stool who attends him when he's off to just take care of business. It's just kind of mind-blowing. And yet you give us a kind of modern window into their thinking at the same time. How do you hold together enough signposts to make us think about the past as another country and yet a modern kind of perspective that allows us to enter, to some degree, their mindset?
I think what you have to do is forget this concentration on language. I am careful about words. I choose them carefully. But I'm even more careful about my character's thoughts. It's very important that they don't have thoughts they couldn't have in the 16th century. And they don't make metaphors they couldn't have. They can't talk about evolution in the way we do. They don't talk about the subconscious. They may have these ideas, but they're nascent. They're new ideas. They're not expressed in those forms. What I try to do is to get my characters to see through 16th century eyes. So Thomas Cromwell, for example, he was in the wool trade. And he'd also been in Venice, which was the centre of the trade in luxury fabrics. Mm. So when some courtier comes along, beautifully dressed up, Thomas Cromwell, in his mind, takes the material off his back, winds it back onto the bolt, measures it in his mind and prices it up. And he can say, oh, she's wearing an outfit worth all of £30. Her family must be on the rise. And his speciality is knowing from their possessions how everyone's doing financially and whether indeed they will soon be coming along to the unofficial bank of Thomas Cromwell for a loan.
Right.
So
in power that resides.
You know, his sensibility as a cloth merchant, as a banker, and the religious sensibility of the time. Everything is filtered through these.
Imagine, if you would, a man or woman of parts today, of learning and insight and experience, someone that we would think of as accomplished, but then somehow, Mark Twain took a hand at this, but throw them back into that court. Would they survive? Would they have the tools from a sophisticated modern life to survive in Henry VIII's court?
Tough for a woman. She wouldn't understand how other women accepted their place meekly, how they accepted the idea of their own inferiority, their disempowerment. She'd probably get into all sorts of trouble. A male politician, I think, would find it very strange because the pace is so slow. You've got the printing press. Ideas can be diffused all over Europe, but they take maybe 3 months. That's fast. It takes a letter, 10 days at the minimum, maybe even 3 weeks to get to Italy, let's say. It would appear that the pace is leisurely and slow, but people are terribly fast to react. A crisis blows up in minutes. And Anne Boleyn, for example, from the first hints of her impending destruction to her death in the Tower of London, 3 weeks.
And the raw exercise of power, how do you think a British Prime Minister out of today's headlines?
This is interesting because, you know, Henry's king, but he's also his own prime minister, his own foreign minister. He has to decide how much power to delegate. Now, he realizes by this stage in his reign that he gave Wolsey far too much power. He's intent on not handing over that kind of power again, while Thomas Cromwell is intent on taking it. He's in many ways a far more capable man than Henry. And would have made a far better king.
And there we are, right in the midst of the history that comes to life so vividly in Hilary Mantel's work. In Wolf Hall, that won the Man Booker Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award, in its sequel, Bring Up the Bodies, just out now, she joins us today from Exeter, England. Hilary Mantel, it's been really a pleasure talking with you. Good luck with the third and final volume here, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. A little glimpse into history. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.